Welcome to the podcast of the Student Christian Movement. SCM is a community of students, past and present, and it is community that is at the heart of who we are and how we do things. Based in the UK, our vision of SCM is as a generous community, expressing a lived faith in Jesus Christ where social action meets prayerful devotion. We seek to be both a radical voice for equality and justice, and a safe home for progressive Christian students. So hello and welcome back to the SCM podcast. You may be wondering, it's not a Wednesday, so why is there a podcast out today? Well, this is a bonus episode with the Reverend Naomi Nixon. So welcome onto the podcast today, Naomi.
Thank you very much.
Well, if people don't know who you are already, if they're not engaged with SCM in any way and haven't heard of you, can you tell us a little bit about who you are?
Of course I can. So I'm Naomi Nixon and I'm the CEO of the Student Christian Movement. And I've been doing that for 3.5 years now because time has flown by in the strange years of the pandemic and afterwards. And I'm also a Church of England priest, so I know a bit more about the machinations of General Synod than I might do otherwise. And my partner Charlotte used to be a rep on General Synod, so it used to be a household matter as well as just something more broadly know about.
That's great. And so the podcast episode today is specifically about the fact that next week the Church of England's General Synod is coming up. Now, I'm not part of the Church of England. I'm part of the Church of Scotland, which is a Presbyterian denomination made up of parishes and presbyteries, and it has a General Assembly each year. So not knowing much about the Church of England other than its structure and general beliefs as an Anglican denomination. So what is the General Synod and why is it important?
Happy to answer that question. And it used to be not called General Synod. It used to be called Church Assembly. I think it was the 1950s that it changed to being called General Synod. And Synod just means, Syn means, in the S-Y-N, means together, and odd means walking. So it basically means walking together, a path together. And so a beautiful concept, a beautiful and Christian concept. And some of the time, that's what it really is. The thing that is really distinctive about General Synod over and above other church meetings is that the laws, things that it passes, become law in England. So Parliament is obviously one body that can make English law, but General Synod can also make English law. And because of that, it means that the processes by which things get decided, there's a very high bar in terms of the processes necessary. And sometimes that's immensely frustrating, particularly when it's about pastoral matters and matters of justice. And obviously the living in love and faith process about how we welcome and include and affirm queer people and relationships. It's both about justice and it's pastoral. So there's a kind of a clash of Church of England stuff going on there.
Yeah, it's a lot. And when it comes to next week's General Synod, it is of particular importance, especially for an organisation like SCM, in terms of the topics that are going to be discussed. So what is it that is being discussed at the Synod? And what are the prayers of love and faith that you just mentioned there?
Okay, so quite a few years ago now, I think 6 or 7 years ago, the Church of England won. There were a lot of moves in the Church of England from progressives like us who wanted the Church of England to update its guidance about queer people, but also to repent of the past and be looking towards gay marriage. The process that we're kind of at the sort of outcome end of a process that got set up then, well-meaning stuff about let's talk to each other, let's get to know each other, let's share stuff about how this is personal for all of us. And it was all really well-intentioned, but fairly gruesome and difficult for queer people and allies to kind of trudge through, and no doubt also for conservatives in different ways. And there was a kind of this whole process, but then eventually it still has to come back to the debates, the laws, the votes, and that's the end of the thing that we're at now. So the prayers of love and faith, so living in love and faith is the process, the journey, if you like. Prayers of love and faith are a specific outcome, and they are essentially prayers that have been written and commended by the House of Bishops to say blessings on people who have entered into gay marriages, same-sex marriages, I should say. They were, earlier on in the year, they were voted on at General Synod, as was a broad kind of welcome and statement of repentance about the way that LGBTQ plus people have been treated in the church in the past. In order for stuff to actually become established in the Church of England, it has to go through more than one kind of vote. And so without getting into all the technicalities of that, that's why it's come back here. So basically they went away, there's a broad yes, they went away to do some more specific work, and it's coming back to Synod again. Over the last couple of months, there has been a lot of back and forth on what is actually going to be brought before Synod to actually be voted on. And it was going to be a standalone service, so a service of blessings, so people could have a civil wedding and then they could come to church for a service of blessing, much like divorced people used to before they were able to get married in church. That has been rolled back. So now it's just prayers within another service. And the suggestion is that the standalone service is something that requires a higher level of voting. So the three houses within General Synod, the bishops, the clergy, and the laity, which kind of, if you compare that to, it's the House of Commons and the House of Lords, and a bill has to go through both of them. It's not quite like that because they all sit in the same chamber, but it kind of helps to think of it that way. So sometimes they vote on things just as a simple majority, the whole house, the whole of General Synod together. Often they vote by houses, and anything, if they vote by houses to something to pass, it has to pass in all three. Essentially where we are in terms of progressive conservative split in those three houses is a healthy majority in House of Bishops who are a progressive and affirming, a healthy majority in the House of Clergy, but very, very close run thing in the House of Laity. And that's often the case, if not always. Women bishops, women priests, again, it was the House of Laity that tended to be the more cautious. The shift that has been proposed, which has got a lot of people very upset, is that it won't just be a simple vote of a 50-50 vote in those three houses. It is going to require a two-thirds majority, which is what women priests, for example, required. And it's when there's going to be a change of doctrine. There are other processes as well, but let's not worry about those. So that's kind of a bit of the kind of process stuff about why people are very upset, because it means that the standalone service cannot be voted on immediately and is unlikely to be passed in this, it's called quinquennium, this 5-year term of these people who got voted onto General Synod, which means that it's a few years away.
Okay, so to summarize then from what I've heard from that is that the living in love and faith process is this process of discussion and learning together about what it would look like to have same-sex blessings for marriages within the Church of England, and the specific prayers of love and faith are for Church of England services, and the debate is happening over whether or not that's going to be a standalone service or a service that is just including the prayers but is actually a separate service, and that's being voted.
Like Evensong with some prayers of blessing for gay people. It's hard not to make it sound silly. I am very sure that the people who construct these services will do so beautifully and with a great deal of grace, and they'll be incredibly meaningful. It's frustrating that a standalone service is the more obvious thing to do.
If it was to get put through that way could it technically be the case that someone within the Church of England could construct the service in such a way that they, for example, give 5 minutes to the rest of the service and 55 minutes to the blessing?
Yes, absolutely. And the thing is, of course, it's all very well having rules, but then there's something about how people follow them. And every clergy person in the Church of England probably breaks the rules at some point. I don't mean these specific rules. I mean, because there are lots of rules. So before, you know, until very recently, you had to robe for services, for example. And there were lots of low church clergy who didn't robe even when it was law that they had to. Nobody went to clergy prison over that. And likewise, at the you know, other end of the spectrum, they're Anglo-Catholics. There are some people who use the Roman Rite, so the Catholic service, which is not authorised liturgy under Church of England law. So those, actually, people do break the rules all the time, but there is a broad consensus of rule following that kind of carries the church. And often, robes being a really good example about this, that when the rule breaking kind of, the law ends up following practice in a bit, it just sort of catches up. The thing is, of course, that this is much more passionately contested. So the fear is that that any clergy person who pushes the boundaries a bit of what's allowed will be opponents who are looking for people doing that so that they can launch complaints about them. And there's a lot of nervousness around that. Because, you know, at the moment, if you were to, you know, and until the rules have changed, you know, you could lose your job and lose your livelihood. So yeah, it's, nobody knows what could happen, I suppose, because there's a general kindness and understanding around the sort of fuzzy edges of the Church of England as it stands. And nobody quite knows what that will actually be like if people blur the edges of the rules over the next few years.
Yeah. One thing I'd be interested to hear a little bit more about is how long these conversations have been happening for, because when you look at a lot of the other mainline denominations in the UK, like the Methodists, yeah, the URC, the Church of Scotland, they all allow for same-sex marriage. So when did these discussions start about blessings, and when did the topic of same-sex marriage come into the conversation in the Church of England, and can we expect to see that anytime in the near future coming more to the fore?
Really good question. So, and I should say I'm not an expert. This is from my memory. I've been ordained for over 20 years. Yeah, so this is my impressions and memories rather than it might be written in a history book, because I might be wrong. So I would say back when I was at college 25 years ago, people were talking about gay people and about kind of whether it was okay to be gay. And even I went to an evangelical college, and it wasn't a hot button issue. It wasn't something people divided themselves about. It wasn't something that people talked about very much. Occasionally, like, someone would write an essay about it or something, and so then there would end up being a bit of chat. Or Charlotte went on a placement in Soho, and so did her placement report around the particularly inclusive church that she was in there. And so, you know, I remember us kind of talking with peers a bit then, but the extent to which we weren't talking about it 25 years ago is massive. And the thing I remember from my peers, particularly the younger ones, is like, well, you know, people are gay. And I think there was a bit of a, like, there were some people who would have been in a love the sinner, hate the sin kind of a place. And there were other people who were just fine, but it just wasn't something that we talked about a lot. So at what point did it become, I suppose, when civil partnerships were first offered, of course, then there was the question about whether clergy could enter into those, and that we haven't talked about thus far, because General Synod next week are not voting on whether clergy are going to be able to enter into marriage. At the moment, if you got married in the Church of England as a clergy person, you either get sacked or you certainly wouldn't be able to get your next job. And that's obviously a huge thing. And because the Church of England holds that sex is within marriage, of course, that's also saying that clergy in same-sex relationships can't have sex. So it's obviously a very big deal for clergy. In a slightly different way to it's a very big deal for people wanting to get married in church. Essentially, civil partnership, I would say, became a more popular alternative once marriage became an idea, and then suddenly clergy being in civil partnerships wasn't as bad as the idea of them getting married. But I still think that when marriage was brought in, there wasn't a huge clamouring for it within any of the churches. It was more, right, okay, well, the government are doing this thing. What are we going to do about it? Other people would no doubt have been in different groups of people and would have found that different. But I would say really it was when civil marriage for same-sex people became an option that the church certainly had no choice but to look at it. And really this living in love and faith process of let's all talk about it. And the idea was that it would get us to a better place, a place of more deep understanding and care. I think the Methodist Church also embarked on a similar thing, although a shorter process. Maybe it was better because it was shorter. Maybe it was better because of just the way their conference works and who comes to it and the way. Maybe it was handled better. Maybe it only seems better because it's not my church. But certainly they are ahead of us in terms of that there are Methodist churches. You know, local churches are allowed to decide for themselves whether they offer same-sex marriages. Of course, the Church of England doesn't work quite like that. It's not just up to local churches to decide. It has to be this is something to do with being an established church, is that opposite-sex couple have a right to be married in their local church. The vicar doesn't have to do the wedding, but if you live in that parish or you've got other qualifying connections, you have a right to be able to get married there. Whereas it's different in other denominations because they don't have that legal bond to the community that they serve. So the question would be, what's the legal relationship with a gay couple? Do they have a right to get married in the local church? That's one of many, many questions that it raises. So whilst it's frustratingly slow, I can understand that there are reasons why, that there are lots and lots of consequences that have to be thought through and then rules have to be written about because of the established nature of the church.
Yeah, I think one thing that's important to note as well, I know that it's the case in the Church of Scotland that even though they allow for same-sex marriage and for ministers to be in a same-sex marriage, that is not forced upon ministers who disagree with that to actually administer those weddings or to conduct those weddings. Is that the case with these prayers, these blessings in the Church of England?
Yeah. There's a lot of nervousness about that. And from the progressive point of view, it's a bit hard to understand why there's nervousness about it. We've been through this with divorce. So the church has to be made available, but the minister doesn't have to do the service. This exactly the same would apply if it was marriage. We're not even talking about marriage. We're talking about services of blessing, which means that there won't be a legal requirement to allow the, you know, any more than there is for any other prayers to be said in a church. So it will be up to the local churches. Exactly the way that's mapped out is in some of the guidance that's coming to General Synod, some of what they'll debate next week. There's also kind of massive pastoral guidance that's being worked on to kind of go alongside. One of the things I'm exceptionally thrilled about is that the papers for General Synod include a requirement that churches are transparent. They use the word transparent about what their approach is to LGBTQ plus people. And I feel that Honest Church, the SEM's Honest Church campaign has been a part of the story that's come to that being written into the guidance. I'm really proud of that. That's become something that we're talking about nationally. But no clergy person would ever be forced into presiding over a same-sex marriage. And I mean, also, what couple would want that? You know, what a way to begin your relationship. You want the person who's praying for you to mean it with their whole heart. And so I just don't see that as being controversial. It will be written into the guidance, and no one would want it any differently. I wouldn't want, like, for all I'm frustrated at my clergy colleagues for not seeing the world the way that I do, I wouldn't wish them to be placed in a compromised position. It would be hideous to make them say things they didn't mean. So which of us would ask them to do that? Surely none of us.
Yeah. And one of the implications really that's maybe slightly different for the Church of England than, say, for example, the discussions in the Church of Scotland is that there is a wider Anglican communion, which is affected and interested in the decisions that are made at the General Synod. So where the Church of Scotland has individual parishes that are outside of Scotland, they don't necessarily have this wider communion. There are partner denominations that are Presbyterian, but they aren't officially part of the same denomination, whereas the Church of England has this wider Anglican communion. So what are the implications for this? What sort of discussion does this bring up? It's fairly complicated.
Yeah, it is. And I have heard some people say on the progressive end of things that there are some conservatives who seem to be discovering the Anglican Communion and that it's deeply important to them in a way that perhaps we haven't ever heard them express before. But I wouldn't be so cynical. The thing is with the Anglican Communion situation is that the moment you start talking about it, you risk appropriating other people's church and their church culture, and but also their kind of nationhood culture, and into your own arguments, and both progressives and conservatives can do that, and I'm really cautious about that, in particular because the majority of the Anglican Church internationally is non-white, and the term global ethnic majority is absolutely as true in the church, in the Anglican Church, as it is for the population of the whole world. But we don't vote on things by simple majority internationally, not on anything. So yes, there are people who think drastically differently to us in Nigeria, for example. That doesn't worry us on a day-to-day basis very often. There are also provinces within the Anglican Communion who already not just bless gay marriages, but also have gay clergy and actually conduct gay weddings. The Church in Wales is much further ahead in that. It's like a couple of hours drive from where I sit here in Coventry. Like it's not actually a remote thing. It is also really important to say that it can end up coming across a little bit like the African churches are conservative and the white Western churches are progressive. And that's a really hideous mischaracterization and one which leads us down really bad paths. The reality is that there are people, you know, there are queer people in all the countries that we're talking about, and there are allies in all the countries that we're talking about, and there are conservatives in all the countries that we're talking about. Of course, the majorities vary wildly, but ultimately, you can only be responsible for the corner of the kingdom that God's given you to exist in and be in community with others in. Of course, the particular reason why people are stirred up about the Church of England making this change is because the Archbishop of Canterbury leads the Church of England and also leads the Anglican Communion. And these arguments run in parallel with questions about whether that should still be the case, that how much it's a hangover of colonialism and how much that's still appropriate. Should the next archbishop be from somewhere else in the communion? If so, should that person still be the head of the Church of England, or should the two offices be divided? Those are massive questions, which I don't, I have to say, I don't know a great deal about, but I just know that people are talking about them. And and these things sort of collide as big things that people are passionate about and are important, you know, important in terms of writing unintended consequences of history.
Well, the question of colonialism and how it relates today to the Church of England is a very interesting one. Some of the themes of that we'll actually be exploring in a couple of weeks on the podcast. One of the guests that we're having on is Andrew Clark Howard, and we're talking about Dietrich Bonhoeffer in relation to settler colonial theology. So keep an eye out for that. We'll have a wider discussion. It won't necessarily relate to the Church of England specifically, but yeah.
There might be some reflecting back.
Reflecting back, yeah, it would be useful. But yeah, so at SCM, we're obviously committed to promoting LGBTQ plus inclusion, and not just affirmation, but actually a celebration of queer identity. So how should we respond to what is going on at Synod next week?
So I'm going to start by saying I'm not going to tell anybody how they should react. There's a wide diversity of response that's appropriate, even if you're a progressive who's queer identifying or an ally. Either way, I wouldn't want anybody to feel like they must respond in a certain way. I think the first thing we have to do is look after ourselves and after each other, because we don't quite know what will happen next week. But to be honest, it's a mess. People are very upset, and the processes by which papers were prepared for Synod got terribly disrupted, and the meetings certainly that I've been in have got more and more fraught. I don't know what it will play out like. Sometimes you think that a great storm is coming and it ends up being people are sort of more polite and hold back more than you think they're going to. And sometimes the processes of General Synod actually sort of support that British stiff upper lip kind of an approach, or all hell break loose. I really don't know. But even if it's the most mild-mannered version, there are going to be people saying incredibly hurtful things about queer people. Even if we don't watch the live stream, things can pop up on your social media that you weren't intending to see. And so, first of all, absolutely looking after ourselves and each other. I think where people are able to engage, it's really helpful. And I think it's incredibly helpful for the people who are in the Synod chamber who are overwhelmed, and are trying to represent us well, using, I think Twitter becomes a place where you can talk to them while they're in the chamber, because you can post something on Twitter using the hashtag Synod, and there are literally people sitting there with their phones and they read what you write. So I think that if you hear of like somebody saying something that you really, really agree with, saying so, like there's a really good chance they'll see it, and they will be sitting there with their heart thumping, and there will be people back in their home diocese who will be angry with them or pleased with them or whatever. So there is an opportunity to really engage with the people who are there. And I know it's really meaningful when people are able to do that. But I think there's also a question about how much we engage in argument on social media. And this is something everybody has to decide for themselves. But my approach with SCM is we are looking beyond this argument. We know that prayers for gay people will happen. Standalone services will happen. Ultimately, gay marriage in the Church of England will happen. And it will become more widespread in the other denominations. SCM's preparing for a future where affirming is normal, because we really, really believe that it's God's way. And I think it's really important that we keep our eyes on that, rather than we get kind of so caught up in the scuffle that we're wounded and we've got nothing left for the Christian life we want to lead kind of beyond it. And I think there was a really important balance how much we torment ourselves in the fight. There are a lot of us in this. We can take turns. looking beyond it and making sure that we take care of one another and we take care of our churches so that they are the places of welcome that we're fighting for. What we're going to be doing from the SEM socials accounts next week is we're going to be posting about the fruits of the Spirit and how queer relationships exhibit the fruits of the Spirit, as the Bible has given us a discernment tool with that list of the fruits of the Spirit that help us to know what is from God. And you look at love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Those are things we see in abundance in queer relationships. And so we want to be kind of pointing that out, and we want our challenge to the Church of England to be coming from the kind of holiness that we see in queer relationships rather than purely from anger. It's not just because we feel it and it hurts us and we want to elbow our way in, or we want people to stop hurting us. It's because it's of God and because it's good and true and it's the church we want to see. And I think it's really, really important that we try and keep our challenge as constructive as we can, for our own sake as much as and for the space we're creating online. There are so many — I was talking about unintended consequences a minute ago — but there are so many unintended consequences of every social media post, and I think trying to think how are we helping more than we're hurting in the way that we do that. So that's what SEM's approach will be overall. We'll also seek to repost things when people have said something brilliant, like we'll want to kind of point that out and so on. But I wouldn't blame anybody who keeps their head down. And the thing I would say is keep your head down and pray if you can't engage directly in the debates. But no one should feel bad about that. This is tough stuff.
Yeah, I really like that focus on the fruits of the Spirit. I think as well, for me, one of the things that I'm very passionate about in my role at SEM is helping people to be confident in a progressive faith. And when I say confidence, that really is just a strong sense of faith.
Yeah,
it's not having certainty about like specifics. Yes. It's not that. It's not a black and white thinking, but there is a confidence, and that's not just a confidence in ideas, but a confidence in the person of Jesus and the relationship that we have to God. And I think it comes through particularly well in the new resources with Affirming Christianity, that it really is just setting out a vision of a future for Christianity that is progressive, that does allow for people to exist, not in just a way where they are constantly having to defend themselves and their identity and who they are, but actually confident in the love of God for them and the love of their church community for them as well. And I think that's — absolutely — a really important vision to put across.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. So how — you've already mentioned some of it, but how can LGBTQ plus SEM and Church of England members look after themselves and find healing and welcoming community while what looks like to be potentially hostile discussions concerning their identity are happening next week at Synod?
Yeah, so I we've been thinking a bit about this and making sure that we're going to be pointing people to support. And particularly, I think it might be surprising for people. You never quite know what's going to upset you. And I know we have a lot of members who they're waiting to see, are ordinands going to be able to be in marriages? This makes a difference to their vocation. You know, I know we've got people who have a vocation to ordination in the Church of England, and waiting for these decisions is incredibly impactful. And there are other people who, you know, who are thinking, you know, when are we going to get married, should we do it this year when we can have prayers within another service? Do we wait a bit and see whether we can have something different? It's incredibly impactful for those people. But also then there are just the random things that people can say and throw out or bring up and remind us of. For people who are on campus, then I would say look to your chaplains. At the same time, you know, I mean, of course, not all chaplains are progressive, but many, many are. And you can check that out quite quickly if you're not sure about your local chaplains. We also have an LGBTQ plus Facebook group that's part of SCM. It's a hidden group to give people maximum kind of security. But if you email, I think we've probably put the email in the info of the podcast, you can drop us an email and ask to join that group and you'll be added. And then as well as getting peer support in that group, there are chaplains in the group and they are on hand to help. We specifically added those people for these processes so that there's access to completely confidential help. But also I would say, you know, be kind of checking in with one another. If you're somebody who is not in the Church of England, but you have friends who are, you know, if you can check in with them, that you might be feeling a little bit more robust next week than they are. And so looking to check in with them, or if you're the person who is affected, you know, don't be afraid to ask for help from your progressive friends in other churches. That even if what you want to have is a bit of a rant, you know, rather than it's because you're tearful, it might just be because you're angry and you want to say so. Or you just want somebody to help kind of work through, what do we think went on today? Like, I followed this stuff online and I'm struggling because sometimes following the debates can be really complicated. So that might be the support that you need. I think I want to say, don't be afraid to be a church nerd. That actually, like, you want to understand it, then ask friends to help.
I know that for myself, when I was watching the General Assembly of the Church of Scotland earlier this year, I was watching the live stream and I still struggled to keep up with the debates at points. Not because like the topics weren't interesting, but just some people do talk a lot and drone on and say a lot of maybe unnecessary things in these conversations that are more semantic than anything else. But so keeping track of what's happening is a lot. But thank you very much for coming on to talk about this today. I particularly want to just give you credit for the way in which you have brought this in a very pastoral way. And I think that's the focus that has to come in this conversation, that it has to recognize the real way that this impacts individuals' lives, impacts their relationships, not only with their significant other or with a partner, but with the church, potentially their relationship with God. And taking that pastoral approach is really necessary. So thanks for having the conversation today.
Oh, thanks for asking me. Thank you.